Hey, how you doing? Thanks for downloading the show. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio. My name is Eric. We talk about an eclectic range of DIY topics. Today, I'm here with my friend Will. We're going to be talking about putting your equipment away for winter, fall, it's spring. Put your winter equipment away, a ceiling fan install, and soil tests. Welcome, sir.
How are you doing today?
Well, if you listen to the previous podcast, I'm getting over COVID.
Lots of rest, drink lots of water. You'll be okay.
I cannot imagine what this would be had been. I will do a whole show about it, but I cannot imagine what it would be like to have COVID and not have had the vaccine and then the booster, because it wasn't fun. So I'll be doing a little coughing, but we're just going to move on. So just be healthy. And if you do get sick, I'll just say you're going to have to make like 15 or 20 phone calls to all your friends. And a couple of them are going to say, oh, I'm fine. And then you have to say, go get tested. I'll leave it at that.
It's funny because you have to go through that exercise where you think of, well, who was I around during whatever to make sure that they didn't have any issues or anything like that. So it's actually pretty easy to do. And honestly, I mean, when we got it, nobody really had a concern of necessarily like, oh, okay, well, we'll watch ourselves. And it wasn't like anybody was angry or anything like that or uncomfortable about the conversation. So I think it's kind of become a social norm now.
Yeah. So we both have equipment, outdoor power equipment that is gas powered that we only use in the winter. And I think a lot of people do. And then it sits in the garage all summer. And then when they go to start it up in the fall, it doesn't start.
Yeah, it's funny. I looked back and we did a show back in September talking about getting ready to put all of your equipment away for the winter and getting all of your winter equipment out. Quite honestly, a lot of the same principles apply to the stuff that you use in the winter that now you're going to put away for the summer. So I thought it was a good timely topic since everything is starting to melt for snow and the weather's starting to warm up and people want to get outside. You should look at that power equipment and make sure that, you know, everything's taken care of so next fall it's ready for you.
And I had kind of an aha moment. Anyone that's listened to the show knows that I'm a big proponent of the gas stabilizer. I use the red kind. There's a blue brand. There's several brands out there, but just it keeps the ethanol from ruining your carburetors and this little seals and jets and things in your engine. And then there's always been people that talked about seafoam. And I'm like, what's this thing? Don, the small engine doctor, Donny Boy on YouTube, and he was showing videos about, he had these clear containers of gas with water and how if you poured seafoam in one of them, it would actually absorb the water. And I'm like, oh, what is this? You know? And then I had a friend who had a Husqvarna chainsaw that he had gotten for free from a guy and it had been sitting in a basement for like 10 years or something and he couldn't get it started. And I'm like, well, let me try. So I got a turkey baster, you know, regular gravy turkey baster. I keep that in my chainsaw kit. I pulled out all the old gas. I poured in some sea foam and some brand new pre-mixed two cycle gas and the thing started up right away.
It's amazing. We've used seafoam for our boats and for a lot of our small engines, like the lawnmowers and stuff. But I've been using it more and more even as a way to, I don't want to say it cleans out the system, but it just seems to make everything run a lot smoother, especially on equipment that's a number of years old. I mean, a 10-year-old chainsaw still works just as good as a brand new one as long as it's taken care of. So,
interestingly enough, that same friend had I call them putt-putt generators. They're those smaller generators that are all enclosed. They put out about 2,000 watts. They're about the size of a small suitcase. It's got little wheels a lot of the times. I don't know what that kind is called. It's not a full-size portable generator. You know, the kind that has like a 13-horse motor on it. It has like a 2- or 3-horse motor in it. And it's all enclosed. And he had one and we were working. He lives in a cabin, off-grid cabin, and we were putting up some timbers and stuff. And the little generator is going, brain, 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 and I'm like, what's with this thing? So I happen to have my chainsaw kit in the car, and so I just poured like a half a cup of seafoam into the gas tank. It's a small gas tank in those things. And in like 5 minutes, the engine smoothed out on that little generator.
Now, to be clear, and I think you'll agree with this, we're not saying don't use stabilizer. We're saying also use seafoam. Or are you suggesting using seafoam in place of it?
No, I think you should use both.
Agreed. We like to run a little bit of seafoam per the manufacturer's instructions through the gas tank at the beginning of the season. So when you're getting your lawnmower out and you're getting all of your power equipment out for the summer, I run seafoam through the gas tank then because it seems to kind of level it out, like you said. And then in the fall, we use the stabilizer and maybe a little bit, you know, to take any moisture and condensation out of the gas tank, which will help you in the long haul.
Right, because when gas is stored in a tank in your garage, it's hot, cold, hot, cold, and the moisture comes out of is the word solution, but basically the water starts to puddle and collect, I think usually at the bottom of the tank, and then it gets into the carburetor and it can rust the bowl of the carburetor. And it's all a $9 for a bottle of the stuff, you know.
Right. The other thing I suggest people to do is, like, on your snowblower, stop at the automotive store and pick up a little container of like a grease and grease up the parts, because your snowblower rusts because there's moisture on it. So by greasing some of the moving parts on it, it makes sure that they don't freeze up or seize up over the summertime when it's just sitting there in your garage with, you know, nothing going on.
Again, and there's a lot of moisture in your garage. There's probably a concrete slab. There may not be a vapor barrier under that slab, you know, and it gets hot and humid in a garage. The other thing, in addition to greasing everything, is a spray can of white lithium grease with the little straw attached. And you can shoot that down the little cableways. I don't know if that's the right word, but the shroud that envelops the cables and stuff for the power and the throttle and all that. I'm a big white lithium grease aficionado.
Absolutely. The other thing too is, like, if your snowblower has tires on it, make sure you top off the tires with air because you don't want them going flat. So if you have to move it sometime in the middle of summer because you want to get out something in the back of your garage or whatever, you don't want to have to deal with the flat tires. Keeping them inflated is always good too.
I actually always was negative about a product if I saw it had plastic tires. And now I'm thinking, for a lot of applications, plastic tires are just fine because they don't go flat.
True. Actually, what I like is, like, have you seen the wheelbarrows at the home improvement stores now where they have that little thin, really hard rubber tire and then a metal rim, I guess, would be the rest of it, and it would never go flat. You can run over nails and stuff. We've been swapping out our wheelbarrows at the resort and at our properties for that very reason, that, you know, those types of things always seem to go flat, or the little two-wheel dollies that you roll stuff around on and whatever, those always seem to go flat. So by changing to that, it seemed to work really well for us.
I did see that. The reason to have regular air tires, which, like I have on my chipper shredder, is if you're going over rough ground, like a yard that has some gravel or even a... You'll get a feel for it, but the plastic tires, they're better, I think, for asphalt and cement. And pneumatic tires and air-filled tires are a lot easier to roll across rough terrain. Kind of like your quad, your ATV, you know, has low PSI, big fat tires because it absorbs all the crags and bumps and stuff. Whereas with plastic tires, that would be a little rougher ride. But there is really a place for plastic tires in my life.
Did you know that, like, on your Kubota, because we've done this with ours, so our tractor has air-filled tires, but we took it into the shop, and they basically vacuum the air out of it, and then they fill it with a foam that hardens inside of it, so you still get the kind of the squishiness of the tire, but it'll never go flat. And, like, I have nails stuck in the side of my tires, and we'll pull them right out of the tractor, and the tractor keeps running and everything perfectly fine because the tires never go flat. The guy actually said the tires will wear out long before they ever have an issue where they go flat or get a flat side on them or anything like that. So for us to never have something that you really rely on, like our tractor, to never have the tires go flat, that's kind of an option too that people can look at.
I'd never heard of that before.
Yeah, it's a pretty neat technique. I mean, back in the day, they used to put beet juice or different types of fluids inside the tires. And then kind of when the foam technology kind of caught up, now they fill the tires with a foam. Granted, it is a little bit rougher of a ride. You don't get that pneumatic benefit of an air right. tire where it takes out the bumps. It takes out a little bit, but I'd rather have a rougher ride and know it works every time versus having to worry about, okay, now we've got a, you know, a $700 tire, a $600 tire that's flat and we got to figure out how to fix it.
Yeah, out in the woods.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about ceiling fan installs that are 12 feet in the air. What fun. Hey, would you be interested in supporting the show and getting some behind-the-scenes stuff that I don't share out to the general public? I've talked about Patreon before here. It's a program where it's kind of like the PBS model of a monthly support. So I'm asking for a cup of fancy coffee a month, if you'd like to consider that. And in return, I share with you sometimes stuff four times a week. Sometimes it's once a week. It just depends on where my brain is at. But I'm looking at the posts I've done recently. You can get them by email or on the Patreon app. The Patreon app is a much better experience, I think, but also by email. First of all, you get an after show for every podcast. So whoever I'm talking to in the show, we usually want to talk about something else and it doesn't quite fit into what we're talking about. So we do it as the after show for patrons. And something I just posted to the Patreons, to my patrons, I found Garden Fork episode number 101 yesterday. And I posted it for patrons, which can be listened to in your podcast app. So the after show has its own unique RSS feed that you can plug into your podcast player, whichever one it is. And so in addition to the regular show on your podcast app, the after show shows up as well. So, and my phone just shut down. So nice. A post called Donut Alone Time. There's a picture of me feeding the Labrador some breakfast. A picture of Andy staring at the camera. I got my ATV, my quad, stuck in the snow, and I was talking, I took some pictures about how I got it unstuck. Progresses on editing I'm doing. I do some screen snaps of the edit screen, and like the donut show, I did a little screen grab of my editing. Talking about where to find the serial number on an engine, stuff like this. So, yeah, cup of coffee. Aren't I the greatest promoter of my own show? So cup of coffee a month. There's links in the show notes here. Or go to patreon.com/gardenfork. That's patreon.com/gardenfork, right? Thank you. And hit the recording. Okay. And we're back. I wonder which little Eric commercial I'm going to insert between the shows here.
Are we actually recording or are we going to do a countdown in?
No, we're going to. I just hit the record button.
Trying out a new technique and now I've wrecked it. Sorry, everybody.
If you're thinking about an e-bike, check out the Rad Power Bike. I really like it and it's not just because I have an affiliate relationship with them now. I've been talking about them since before then. But the e-bikes are not cheap. The good ones are not cheap. And these are good. And they're direct to consumer. I'm a big fanboy of them. So there'll be an affiliate link in the show notes here if you want to check that out. But I had to replace the ceiling fans in the rental apartment in our row house. And I forgot how high up in the air they were. And that was not fun.
You know, I watched that video and where the camera was placed, it was hard to tell how tall or how high up you were. But then when you took a step back and you saw you standing on the ground and you couldn't see the top of the ladder, then you knew, okay, that's pretty serious height up there.
I have an 8-foot ladder, but I really need a 10-foot. But the problem is storing that in a house. I mean, we have a narrow, small house, and where are you going to keep a 10-foot stepladder? And I only go up, the ceilings on the third floor are very high, but I'm only up there every 10 years, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But
no,
when you're on an 8-footer, you're kind of, you're at the top rung and you're leaning a little bit. And I'm like, I felt like I should rope my knees to the ladder, you know?
Then when you're done later on that day, you're sitting in the easy chair and you're like, why are the front of my legs so sore? And it's because you had your legs locked and you're trying to hold yourself and your weight plus do all the work. It's a position you're not normally in life.
It also helps just to have someone else help you. And I didn't have that, but I always assemble the ceiling fan up in the air. Some people assemble them on the ground and then, you know, you got to hump this thing all the way up and get it to lock on to the mount. That's really a two-person thing.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, maybe you could assemble the motor assembly on the ground. I mean, it depends on the brand you get, but assemble the motor assembly on the ground. But trying to pick up a fan with, you know, the blades on it at the same time and get it at the right spot and get in there is just impossible.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully we have cordless power tools now just to zip the screws right in.
Yes, absolutely. Now, are all those fans, did you put remote controls in with them? I can't remember.
No, I'm actually very anti-remote control when it comes to ceiling fans.
Why is that?
Because they break. The remote controls break.
Really?
And then you have to buy a third-party remote control and try and get it to work. And when they're 11 or 12 feet up in the air, I just put pull chains on them.
The part that I hate about the remote controls more than anything, if I'm going to vent for a minute here, why is the controller so big? It's almost impossible to get it into that shroud. Like, you have to kind of wiggle it to try to slide it between and fit. It's like they never thought about that. Hey, by the way, this thing needs to be small because I don't have a 12-inch circle that I can hide this behind. It's usually a little 4-inch thing up on the ceiling.
So you're talking about the remote control electronics that are sitting above the ceiling fan motor.
Right. That's always been my gripe with them, is that the controls are always so big. Like, you don't want to buy one that's built in because once it breaks, you're done. But like, some of the brand names have these little white boxes that you can mount in there to give you the remote control. But they're so large, it's impossible to fit it into that little 4-inch, you know, box that's up on the ceiling, unless you're super magical with it.
Yeah, it's a pain. I'm all about simple, and that's why I just do the pull chains. And actually, I have a video about it, but on one of my ceiling fans, the pull chain switch broke, but it's really easy to fix. Yes, you have to take the ceiling fan off the ceiling to do it, but it's a $5 part, and you're not, I don't know, it's just simpler than trying to cram that remote controller thing up in there under the shroud, under the little decorative part that sticks up onto the sheetrock of the ceiling there.
Yeah. I always wondered why ceiling fan companies never made the switch to change the direction of the fan, you know, on a chain or like on a remote or something like that. It's always that hard switch on the side of the unit, which when you're changing from summer to fall, and if you're one of the people who changed the direction of your ceiling fan for the season, you got to get a ladder, go up there and do it versus, you know, just pressing a button on a remote or pulling a chain or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that would just confuse people too much.
Possibly. I mean, I'm still confused about which way the fan should go, whether it should be clockwise or counterclockwise in the fall, and then in the summer, which way you do it. It's just, I always have it wrong, I'm guessing.
That's okay. What a lot of people don't realize is that ceiling fans don't cool the air. They cool your skin.
Interesting.
So, like, I have tenants that leave the ceiling fans on all day when they're not home, and I'm like, because we have a solar powered house, I'm like, you got to turn those off when you leave the room. And I sound like this nut job, but ceiling fans work by blowing air over your skin, and it's evaporating a little bit and making you feel cooler. It's perfect for like over a bed or over a couch or your desk or something. But if you just have them running full blast in the living room and you're in the other room on your Zoom call, it's not doing anybody any good. It's just blowing a lot of dust around.
You know, one place I have seen ceiling fans used very well is if you have a fireplace in your house, or if you have a wood stove, or like in a cabin or something like that, the heat from that usually collects up at the top at the ceiling. And yeah. I've seen people successfully use like a heating source like that, and then a ceiling fan on low to kind of push that heat down into the room during the wintertime. But I agree with you 100% that during the summer, a ceiling fan is blowing air on you to cool you off. But in the wintertime, if you have a heat source, forced air furnace or heated floor really doesn't make a difference. But if you have something like a fireplace or something that's putting out a significant amount of BTUs into a space, it's an easy way to move those BTUs from the ceiling down into the space.
Right. So you would have the ceiling fan set on reverse and ideally being located almost above the heat source. And what that would do is essentially push the heat that's hugging the ceiling toward the walls. That heated air hits the walls and then gets pushed down. Right. So that's perfect.
It's kind of the same idea as a convection oven, essentially. I mean, if you think of a regular oven versus a convection oven where they have the fan in there and it circulates the air for the heating source, it's kind of the same thing.
Have you ever run into, you open up a junction box and it's just a nightmare and it's not even mounted to a stud and someone wants a ceiling fan connected to that thing?
Yes, absolutely. I've seen that. Now, if they have boxes now where you can slide a rod up in there, and if you can reach into the hole, put a screw into a joist on either side or a ceiling rafter or whatever, and then you mount a metal or a plastic box to that. But honestly, in a lot of those scenarios, they're very challenging to install. The other one is if let's say you're wanting to put a ceiling fan up in a space and the ceiling joist is right there where you want to put it, they now have a box actually that looks like kind of like a U-shape on the back of it, and you can slide it up on either side of that 2x4 or 2x6 or 2x8 or whatever it is, and then there's a screw that goes sideways between it so that then it doesn't span between the spaces. It slides right up over the 2x4. We've used that before, and the box is really narrow so that then it's only the thickness of a 2x4, or not a 2x4, but sheetrock, so it ends up being flush with the ceiling once you put it in.
Yeah, I have seen those, and they're really nice. I always put a couple of really big screws into the box. And if it isn't on a joist, I won't put a ceiling fan in it. I mean, around here, the houses were originally lit with gas. So you had these very shallow mounted, they retrofitted gas chandelier holders into electrical boxes. And they're just hanging on a brass gas pipe. And then they're like, oh, we want a ceiling fan there. And I'm like, well, no, you know, and I'll take it apart and put in a nice J box. But it's just kind of surprising what you will find when you open up walls of old houses.
Yes. And it's always a challenge. I people ask me, you know, what's better, new construction or remodeling? And quite honestly, when you have a clean slate of, you know, a slab of concrete or a foundation, you can build everything from scratch. I honestly think new construction is way easier than doing a remodel. These DIY remodel jobs and things like that, when you open up the walls, you just never know what you're going to find in there. And then once you open it up, that's when the challenge goes is, okay, I know what I want it to end like, and I know what we have. How do I bridge the gap between those is where the goofy stuff comes into play.
Extension cords.
Oh, did I ever tell you the story about, we had a house where if you touch the sink in the bathroom and touch the light fixture on the wall, you get electrocuted. Come to find out, the owner or the previous person, you know, that wire that's that lamp cord that you get, you know, that you see where it's like just two wires with a little bit of shielding on it.
Yeah, we call it zip cord.
Yeah. So they usually use them for like lamps and things like that if a wire is going across the ground to go to the outlet. Well, the guy cut the ends off of it and then wired into the kitchen the electrical, and then all of the electrical for the bathroom and the laundry room was running through that one cord off of one outlet in the kitchen. How did it not burn down?
Oh, yeah.
There's a website online. I don't know if it's still up or not, but it was called There I Fixed It. And it was all the goofy things like that, like people who put water heaters laying on their side in attics and, you know, duct tape and like a door. If it gets stuck around a cabinet, they cut a little square out of the door so the door swings past the cabinet. But now there's a big hole in the door.
I'm looking pretty good right now.
Yeah, I look at that and I feel better about myself.
All right, when we come back, soil tests. The big question is, do we know anything about them?
Hey,
Hey, have you signed up for Masterclass yet? Well, come on, let's go. If you're tired of like, oh, what are we going to watch tonight? And you're trying to find something maybe on PBS or a documentary, why don't you check out Masterclass? It's like curated high-end YouTube from people that are living... You know, on YouTube, there's like these experts and you're like, well, how do you... They're like, this is the way to do it. And you're like, okay. And they're like, oh, I've done this, this, and this. But you, have they really? So the people on Masterclass, well, you know them and they have. That's pretty good, right? I didn't write that. I just did that right off the top of my head. Pretty good. Anyway, yeah, obviously we do get an affiliate finder's fee from you signing up for Masterclass. But I genuinely like Masterclass. We were actually talking about this in the after show, but I get inundated with... stuff to feature in the podcast and the videos, and if I don't believe in it, I won't do it, you know. So I like this. I like Masterclass. If you want to use the link we have, really appreciate that. Helps pay the bills here. All right, let's go back to the show. So Aaron, the impatient gardener who is not on the show, told me to get soil tests done for my raised beds. And so, of course, I made a video about digging up soil in my garden. It's featuring the Labradors being big goofballs. That was the funnest part. And the camera operator commentary was quite good.
Yes, and I thought the audience was heckling you very well in that video.
Yeah. All shot with an iPhone 8, everyone. You don't need fancy equipment. If you want to make a video, just... good audio is really incredibly important, and a good content, you know, having an engaging person in front of the camera doesn't hurt, you know, but it's amazing what you can shoot with your iPhone.
You're telling me that that really super nice camera doesn't make my content any better? It's the quality of the person on the camera?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good to know. I'll write that down.
So it was interesting because I mentioned the soil tests, and my people that watch the show on YouTube were all asking these deep dive questions, and also my patrons were as well on Patreon. And all of a sudden, I'm like, "Oh, I'm out of my element here." All I knew to do was to dig out this dirt and mix it up in the bucket, and take out a sample of that, and label it and write a check.
I find it interesting that that service is available basically in every state. After I watched the video, I looked online to see, because I always thought soil testing was, you know, throw a little in your mouth. If it tastes okay, you're good to go. And I didn't know that there was a science to this stuff. So I guess Aaron is going to have to explain how this all works. But every state has an extension office where you can contact them or a university and send it to them. And, you know, for a small fee, they would do this. I just think that's the coolest little service.
Yeah, this is the University of Connecticut, and this is part of their agrarian program. I guess I can't remember the exact word. I wrote out the shipping label the other day, but they have a soil science program, and I don't know if they make a profit. I mean, each sample was $15, and I did four samples because I know two of my raised beds. Two sets of my raised beds have the exact same soil in them, because when I built them, I put the same dirt in there and everything. And I thought, wow, this is going to end up being like $90. So I had to deduct a little bit of money from that. But for $15, they give you the whole run. And I'm not sure how long it takes to do that. But then they have to email you, or they have to write you a form letter back. So I don't think they're making a lot of profit. I think what it does is I'm sure it's probably run by students or graduate students or someone like that. But there's also the department, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the state departments of agriculture have what are called extension offices throughout their states because they want to support farmers. And I think in an ancillary way, they're also helping homeowners. And so they offer soil tests as well.
So an interesting item on the soil test, and I know that you guys talk about it for gardening a lot, but I kind of went down the rabbit hole of soil tests, and one of the things I came across was a suggestion where, let's say you have a yard where your grass doesn't grow in a certain part of your yard for some reason, that just it's not just for gardens. You could take some of that soil and have it tested to find out, oh, maybe the acid is too high and that's why the grass always dies there, or there's something missing, so that then if you have a spot in your yard where for whatever reason you can't grow grass, or it's a property that you bought and it's got a really poor backyard with regards to grass, that you can do that same type of testing to tell you what you should add to your soil for your yard also. So I thought that was kind of an interesting spin on the soil testing piece.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, you know, you could buy a house and find out that the backyard has, you know, a toxic waste dump in it and something.
That happens. Oh, look at that. They buried a whole bunch of 55-gallon drums that are leaking.
Yeah, they're glowing. That does happen. Just be careful, everyone. When you, we bought one property, there was a barrel in the garage, and you're like, okay, what's in there? You know?
Yep.
We took care of it. It was fine. It was just old oil, but nonetheless, stuff to Absolutely. Be careful about. But yeah, you can test your yard as well, and you can do different areas. You don't have to just test one area and then that's going to be the outcome for the rest of the yard. You can have different problem areas.
Yeah, because I mean, depending on what you have going on, like we have an area at one of our properties where there's a whole bunch of pine trees and the grass just dies constantly under there. And we did a little research, come to find out you get some, I think it's pelletized lime, you know, the little pellets, yep. and basically sprinkle it around out there and it kind of sweetens the soil. Then we put the grass seed down and boom, we've got grass under the pine trees now. And it was, you know, we had to rake up the pine needles and everything like that, sweeten the soil a little bit, but it's stuck and it's no longer a mud patch on the property.
Yeah, you'll have to do the lime treatment on a regular basis now.
Yep.
But pelletized lime is $6 a bag, so...
And it goes forever. I mean, it's a bag you can do a very large area with.
So everyone, when we say pelletized lime, limestone is quarried, and it's usually then turned into a powder, which farmers use and they spread it on their fields. But as an additional process, the quarry or the processor will pelletize the lime. So they kind of compact it into little pellets, little BBs or little yep. mini ball bearings. And it's much easier to spread in a yard that way than buying the powder. If you buy the powdered stuff, it's like trying to spread talcum powder in your yard, and it just goes everywhere.
Learn from me, by the way, no matter if you have the pellets or if you have the powder, wear a mask, because that powder and everything, you're breathing it in and it'll build up in your nostrils and everything like that. And like I woke up the next morning and I had a bloody nose and I'm like, oh, it was from that. So
yeah, avoid the bloody nose. Well, cool. So I am amazed at how kind of the desire to go take a nap, even though I just woke up only a couple hours ago. So it's going to be a little bit of a shorter show here. We do have one juicy thing we're going to save for the patrons, and that's the new clothing optional colony camp resort that Will is talking about starting. Anyway, thanks for listening. If you're interested in becoming a supporter or a patron, there's information below. Thanks for listening. Go out and do cool stuff and make it a great day. Garden Fork Radio is produced by Garden Fork Media LLC in Brooklyn, New York. Our producer is Sean O'Neill. If you need an amazing podcast producer, visit Sean's site, seaninbrooklyn.com. That's Sean, S-E-A-N, in Brooklyn.com. Our executive producer is Jimmy Goose. For more information about Jimmy and the custom hollow books he makes, visit hollowbooks.com. The music in the show is licensed from audioblocks.com and uniquetracks.com.